From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Flu season is fully upon us, off to a brutal start, and it could get even worse, possibly the worst since the 2009 swine flu outbreak. Widespread activity across 49 states, only isolated Hawaii, an ocean away, spared the worst. Epidemic proportions, tens of thousands hospitalized. This year's dominant strain, H3N2, is particularly nasty. Worse for older people and those with chronic conditions. At least 30 children have died. This hour On Point, taking the nation's temperature with the country's top flu experts. You can join us on air or online. Has it been a ferocious flu season where you are? Slammed your school, your office? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first this hour from Bolingbrook, Illinois, is Dr. Shelley Flace, a pediatrician practicing in the Chicago suburbs. She's also a professor of clinical pediatrics at Northwestern University. Dr. Flace, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for the opportunity to speak about this important issue.
Well, it is, and thank you for being here. What are you seeing in your clinics this flu season?
Well, it's definitely, both professionally and personally, everybody's talking about it. I actually was at a swim meet with my family this weekend, and the other families on the swim team were asking, what are we seeing? What's going on? Everyone's talking about it. Yesterday, I was in our busiest office. Our practice is Pediatric Health Associates. We're based in the Naperville suburbs. We have 6-7 doctors typically seeing patients, all pediatricians. It's wonderful because we can compare notes and see what's going on in the community. Keep in mind that a typical Monday in January, it's our what we call sick season, meaning we're seeing plenty of sick kiddos. There's a lot going around this time of year. But what is different for January 2018 is that the sheer number of influenza that we're dealing with is definitely a departure from the most recent 5 years or so.
Here's a compilation right now of alarming news reports of this year's flu season. Here's NBC's Kristen Dahlgren on Friday.
Across the country,
the flu has claimed another life in Massachusetts.
It's getting even more deadly in California.
The flu is hitting hard and fast.
By Tuesday morning, he was gone.
Young and old, even previously healthy people are dying. An aggressive strain circulating.
8-year-old Tyler Danaway passed away from the flu in Little Rock, Arkansas a week ago. Despite having received a flu shot, Tyler's parents, Steve and Teresa, told CNN they were shocked.
It's just mind-boggling. And you can't, there's no way to wrap your hands around it. And just from to be here, happy, giggling, laughing his head off, and then 2 days later be gone is,
there's no words.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Flace, 30 children across the country have died so far this year from the flu. How unusual is that, and does that concern you?
Absolutely. It's definitely concerning, and any death is a tragedy. There's no question about it. I think that in the last several years, families often get complacent about what we call the flu. I'm actually personally trying to refer to it more as influenza to differentiate it. Sometimes people think the flu is just a bad cold. You miss school a couple days, or even vomiting, diarrhea, which is usually what we call gastroenteritis, which is a stomach flu, totally different virus. Influenza is a respiratory virus that rapidly changes, hence the need for the yearly vaccine. And it is definitely a different animal that unfortunately in 2009 and then the pandemic of 1918, which was ironically 100 years ago, we do see that it can change and have terrible consequences for a community. Pediatricians are all about prevention and reducing risks. So we definitely emphasize to our families, it's not too late to get the flu vaccine. It's a wonderful idea every fall, but if you haven't had it yet this year, you should go ahead and do that. Even if it's not 100% effective, it helps reduce the risks, complications, and the risk of death. It's the best analogy that I typically share with families in the office is it's like wearing a seatbelt when you drive in the car. We're not planning on driving. We plan on driving safely. You never know if you'll be hit at a red light by a texting driver. Similarly, if a seatbelt can reduce your risks of an accident, the flu vaccine, if there's a chance that it could reduce the complications of the influenza, it's worth that. It's safe and effective, and it's a smart idea. Mm-hmm. Also, hand washing, using good common sense, wiping down surfaces, staying home when you're not feeling well yourself. These are all the boring things that people take for granted. Yeah. They're not exciting. They're not new technology, but they are very effective in reducing the spread of influenza.
So as I understand it, the flu season typically peaks in February, starts to abate in March, but this year it hit early, even in December, right?
Exactly. Definitely before the holidays, we were already seeing an uptick. And then there's always the question, are we simply seeing this hit sooner in the year than typical, or are we seeing the beginning of the rise of the mountain? And that's what's so difficult to predict. That is what is difficult to predict about influenza on a yearly basis, which is why medical and public health experts typically say, get your flu vaccine in the fall, because we don't know what this year will bring.
So it seems the dominant strain of this particular flu, this particularly virulent flu, is called H3N2. Hits younger people harder. Is that right, doctor?
Yes, and some feel that younger people develop a stronger immune response that basically overwhelms and takes over. And definitely that's something that we are concerned about as pediatricians, specifically infants younger than 6 months. I saw a family in the office yesterday. They have a 2-month-old with an older sibling who attends daycare. Parents had questions, should we be limiting older siblings' exposures because baby's too young to receive the vaccine? And so we are concerned about members of our community who are either too young to receive the vaccine, or if they have a heart condition, asthma, underlying chronic medical conditions that put them at greater risk of influenza. That's part of why we promote herd immunity, meaning the more of us who are protected, the more we can do to protect those others. Mm.
Dr. Shelley Flace is a pediatrician in the Chicago suburbs of Bolingbrook and Naperville. Dr. Flace, thank you so much for your time, and we really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. Joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is Dr. William Schaffner, professor of preventative medicine in the Department of Health Policy at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He's also a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases. Dr. Schaffner, welcome back to On Point. Always nice to have you.
Good to be with you, Jane, even though it's a tough subject.
It is. It is. And we just heard from Dr. Flace, the pediatrician, the good pediatrician there outside Chicago. She's talking about the kids. Talk about, more broadly speaking, who is this affecting?
So this H3N2 virus, this bad virus that's out there now, affects not only young children, but also leads to complications in older adults, people who are age 65 and older, and those younger who have underlying diseases of the heart, the lungs, who have diabetes, asthma, and women who are pregnant. It's not as well known that women, while pregnant, if they get influenza, have rates of complications, pneumonia, hospitalization, that are comparable to people age 65 and older. So this is a severe, on the severe end of the spectrum, flu season because of this nasty virus.
And so what makes this particular virus, doctor, so nasty, this particular strain, H3N2? Isn't this the same strain we saw last year?
It is, and it caused illness last year, but not as much as this year. And frankly, I was surprised that we're getting this much illness, because I would have thought the virus circulating last year had partially vaccinated, if you will, immunized the population. And that apparently is not the case. It didn't get around enough to protect the population this year.
Are we seeing pockets of the flu, doctor, or are you seeing this all over the country?
Well, it blossomed early all over the country, some places more than others, and the ones that were less affected are now kind of catching up. But in our neck of the woods in Middle Tennessee, we're doing surveillance. That is, we're tracking the most serious cases, those that are hospitalized with laboratory-diagnosed influenza, and those cases started early and continue. So we're part of the country that's now stressed out.
There's a new report out which says the flu can be spread simply by breathing. Doctor, how groundbreaking or revelatory is that?
Well, I think we knew that. Most flu is spread if I have influenza and you're standing within 3 to 6 feet of me in an enclosed space, such as a room. I breathe out, and that contains microscopic amounts of the influenza virus. Then you breathe it in, and that influenza virus then can find a home back in your throat or down in your bronchial tubes, and I spread it to you this way. Obviously, coughing and sneezing creates more of an aerosol. And what we've learned just recently, has been nicely documented, is that sometimes these influenza viral particles can actually get beyond 3 to 6 feet. Well, we've kind of known that, but this is now well demonstrated. So this, what we call the respiratory route of spread, is the way influenza spreads most frequently.
Let me get Jody in here, a caller from Dothan, Alabama. Jody, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I'm just calling because I guess I'm giving you an update from the South.
Okay.
We've had a lot of flu in this area in Dothan. In my son's high school, there's been a rampant flu to the point where we've encouraged him when he doesn't have to be at school not to be there, just to stay well. Out of concern. In Fairhope, Alabama, I've had friends that have been very, very ill with not just respiratory but stomach kind of virus, but a flu that debilitated and kept them out sick for weeks. And daughter is in Oxford, Mississippi, at Ole Miss. There are cases there, students that are having to just kind of stay in their room and try not to get anyone else sick with the flu.
Yeah, it's bad, Jody. Thanks so much for the update there from the South, Dr. Schaffner. You hear Jody there. Give us some recommendations for people who are sick to sort of keep it to themselves, if you will.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One, yes, keep it to yourself, what we call social distancing. But as soon as you become sick, call your healthcare provider because they may prescribe an antiviral drug, which can reduce the duration of the illness a little bit and also contributes to a lower rate of complications, the pneumonia, the hospitalization, and dying. And as I like to say, when you're in a community where you're having an influenza outbreak, and if you're one of the people older or you have underlying diseases, that's the time to rent a movie rather than going to the movie. You don't want to get out there in crowds.
Dr.
Be
William.
A bit of a hermit.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of Ask Me Another. We headed out to L.A. for two all-celebrity contestant shows, and the competition was more intense than the traffic on the 405. Linda Cardellini, Jeff Garland, Lance Reddick, and Paul Rust. Only one took home an Ask Me Another Rubik's Cube. Find Ask Me Another on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're looking at this year's deadly flu season and what it means going forward, and you can join the conversation. Is taking a sick day an option where you work? Are you wondering why it's taking so long to get a flu vaccine that works 100% of the time? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Bill Schaffner, professor of preventative medicine at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Here is Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, describing the effectiveness of this year's flu vaccine in an interview with the Associated Press on Thursday.
The CDC and my folks and myself personally think it's likely going to be around 30%. But having said that, it is always better to get vaccinated than not to get vaccinated, because any degree of protection is better than no protection at all.
Dr. Schaffner, 30% doesn't sound so good to me. So help me understand why you should, I mean, I understand you should get a flu vaccine because it will help you if you get the flu. But talk about that number, 30%.
Well, let's recognize that the influenza vaccine that we have today is imperfect. It's a good but far from great vaccine. It happens to be the best that science can produce for us right at the moment. 30% is not great. I hope it's that good against H3N2. It also, you know, it's a multi-component vaccine, so it also provides some protection against the other strains, and usually better. It also, once you get illness despite the vaccine, there are reasonable data to suggest that you're less likely to get the complications. So you'll have a less severe case, you're less likely to get pneumonia or have to be hospitalized. And as a clinician, I'm just happy for any degree of prevention against this really bad infection.
Let's go to Grand Lake, Michigan with Brad on this point. Brad, welcome to On Point. Brad, are you there?
Yeah.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, Jane. I just want to ask a question, though. Everybody keeps the doctor keeps talking like 30%. And the thing is, to me, is there's three different strains, or three or almost four different strains of the flu virus. And it seems like every year they're just making a pick of which one that's going to work. And to me, why can't they just, once the flu comes out, obviously he's stating that the flu, the shot that we got for last year is good for the one this year.
Yep.
Why aren't they bringing the shot last year back out now for this year?
All right, Brad, let's find out. Dr. Schaffner, help us. Help us here.
So what happens is the World Health Organization does surveillance for influenza around the world. And twice a year, once for the Southern Hemisphere, once for the Northern Hemisphere, the experts get together to try to anticipate which are going to be the most commonly circulating flu strains. And they formulate the vaccine in order to combat those. It's multi-compartmental. We get either protection against three or four strains of influenza each year. So we're doing the best to try to predict in advance. What we would all like in the future, oh, we're yearning for this, is what we call a quote-quote universal influenza vaccine. Wouldn't it be great if we had one vaccine that could protect against all the strains? Now, we're a little bit closer scientifically to that than we were. There are candidate vaccines now just starting in clinical trials. So let's keep our fingers crossed. But in the meantime, I like to paraphrase that old French philosopher Voltaire who said, waiting for perfection is the great enemy of the current good. So we can still do a lot of good with our kind of good flu vaccine that we use now.
But what you are saying, doctor, is to determine the composition of the vaccine, to our caller's point, is a lot of guesswork. And I guess my question is, are we seeing more deaths because the flu vaccine is not that effective?
Well, first of all, it's not guesswork. I think it's certainly an educated anticipation.
Okay, fair.
But the second thing is that actually, the match is reasonably good, but particularly for H3N2 strains, the vaccine never has been all that great. Just to give you a little bit of background, what happens is we grow most of our flu viruses that we use in the vaccine in chickens' eggs. And when we put this H3N2 strain into the eggs, it mutates slightly in order to multiply well in the eggs. That's good for producing the vaccine, but it gets a little bit off target from the circulating virus, and that makes it a less good vaccine. Mm.
So ineffective, as far as vaccine does, doesn't necessarily mean useless. I hear what you're saying. Let's get to Matthew in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Matthew. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I'm an emergency room nurse, and I've been working in healthcare for almost 15 years now. And I just I wanted to ask the doctor if is there multiple if you have multiple years of vaccination like a healthcare worker does that contribute to your immunity? And the other thing I wanted to say was to your listeners that aren't of medical training, if you start getting sick, try to access care in another way outside of the emergency room, just because we're already overwhelmed. We understand, you know, if there's no other option. And for many, you know, poor people and other vulnerable groups, that's all they can do. And that's totally understandable.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I did want to say, too, is even if you're not part of that vulnerable group, you know, the older patients, the young and the pregnant, I have seen flu take out healthy 20, 30-year-olds without a problem. It's something to be taken seriously. Please don't just think it's a cold.
Indeed it is. Matthew, thank you for that perspective, ER nurse. Matthew, there in Florida. Doctor, to Matthew's two points. First, when do you go to the ER?
Well, you go to the ER if you get really sick. If you're with your flu, you're getting progressively sicker and sicker. If you're having difficulty breathing, if that dry cough suddenly turns productive and you're producing green or gray sputum, and particularly if it has some blood in it, that suggests that you're getting really bad bronchitis and or pneumonia. So all of those things. And mothers, they will take that child to the ER if they just look at the child and know that it's not doing well.
And so to Matthew's first point, as healthcare workers get multiple years of vaccine, does that contribute to their immunity long term?
Well, we can't get into a long scientific discussion, but certainly all healthcare workers should be vaccinated each and every year because that's an ethical and appropriate thing to do. We don't want to give our flu virus to our patients.
I think his question was, though, does it contribute to their own personal immunity? I think that's what he was getting to.
In general, we think yes. Mm-hmm.
Let's get Catherine in here from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Dr. Sefner. I have a quick twofold question here. I've been studying my own family. I have four kids, obviously myself and my husband, and I never got the flu shot when I was a kid. I started getting them when I was pregnant with my first son 10 years ago. And, you know, when you're pregnant, they force you to get the flu shot, which I'm not totally against. But I have noticed with my kids and myself and my husband, any year that we do get the flu shot, we do get the flu. Every year that we seem to forget or I've deliberately opted out, perfectly healthy without the flu. So last year specifically, my two little ones got the flu shot and they had a terrible flu. None of us, no one else in the family got the flu. My other part of this question, well, first of all, I'm wondering if certain people are more susceptible to getting the flu by getting the flu shot. Like not everybody, obviously. Mm-hmm. I know there's some data done by that, done research for that, but...
Good questions, Catherine. Yeah, no, thank you. Let's ask Dr. Schaffner. What do you think, doctor? Just a coincidence that that the family got the flu after the flu shot?
I think Catherine noticed the coincidence, and I would like to emphasize that you cannot get influenza from the influenza vaccine. That's not correct. It just doesn't happen. And the vaccine does not make your infection, should you get it, more severe or make it more likely that you're going to get the infection. Quite the contrary, it helps prevent the infection.
All right, Catherine, thanks for the call. Let me bring another voice into the conversation now from Minneapolis, Minnesota, Michael Osterholm. He's a director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Michael, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks, Jane.
So I've seen reports that hospitals are being pushed to the breaking point with the flu this year. Give us a sense of what's happening across the country as you see it.
We actually have the intersection of two different things happening. I think the show has already clearly delineated the fact that we have a problem with flu this year. But when you look at it, that problem doesn't have to be very bad before it begins to stretch our healthcare systems. What we've pretty much done in the terms of cost savings and the availability of various drugs and medical devices, gnawed our healthcare system down basically to the bone. And as we sometimes say, we're literally sucking calcium. It's a challenge today to provide the kind of health care we need when you have even a slight bump up in need, just because of the fact that we have such a very thin veneer of preparedness in the healthcare system that exists. Mm.
A thin veneer of preparedness. It is difficult for a lot of hospitals to keep up. Here's CBS reporter Nikki Batiste on Saturday detailing some of the preventative measures taken during the current nationwide flu epidemic.
A few California hospitals built tents outside to cater to patient overflow. Some churches are telling parishioners to skip holding hands during prayer to avoid germs. And all schools in Bonham, Texas closed for a week after flu cases there soared.
So, Michael Osterholm, I mean, there you are looking at stories here from Southern California, others from Central Texas, hospitals. Seen so many flu patients that they've set up triage tents, turned other patients away. I mean, talk about this generally. Are we equipped to deal with this sort of an outbreak, especially if it were to get worse?
Well, actually, overall in the healthcare system, we're much less equipped today than we were even 15 years ago. Hmm. And part of that is because we live in a very different kind of economic model for delivering of any kinds of services and goods. For example, we did a study several years ago where we surveyed a group of world-renowned PharmDs, persons who have doctorates in pharmacy. And we asked them, what are those life-saving drugs you have to have every day or people die? Not cancer drugs, most antibiotics, lifestyle drugs, none of those. What's on the crash cart in the emergency room? And we came up with 20 different drug categories. 100% of them were generic. 100% were made outside of the United States. And they are just-in-time delivery. They just get here when we need them. And in many cases, there's big shortages. I gave a talk several years ago in which I said, you know, the next big hurricane that comes through Puerto Rico is going to take out our IV bag capacity for the United States and much of the world. We saw that this year, and now we have had a major shortage of IV bags in our healthcare facilities around the country. This morning, I just received the EMS drug shortage list, which is a compiled list of drugs that are in short or absent supply in emergency rooms around the country, and the list is up to 94 different drugs right now. And so part of the problem is our system is just not made today for resilience. It's not made for surge capacity, and we really don't understand that, because if we were to have something much more severe than this seasonal flu, which we have, and that's what a pandemic would look like, a new strain emerging, the collateral damage, meaning people dying of other causes because they're not able to get the critical life-saving drugs they need, would be substantial.
In fact, you wrote in a New York Times op-ed, quote, "We're not ready for a flu pandemic," essentially saying we need to reconsider the lessons learned from the Spanish flu pandemic that struck the world, interestingly, exactly 100 years ago, Michael.
Yes. You know, I think part of the problem is that, you know, we've recognized for a long time that flu is clearly a very serious public health issue. I've often likened it to the Lion King of infectious diseases. And we even have to go back and look at how do we get the current vaccines we have today. And in fact, they really emerged out of the World War II experience and the work that the Department of Defense did. And the reason they did that is at the time, called the Department of War, they were all remembering that many, many more soldiers died in World War I from the 1918 pandemic of influenza than they died from on what happened on the battlefield. And so they came up with this new vaccine, which unfortunately from the 1940s up until basically very recently, there's been very little changes to that. It's been kind of an improvement on a technology, but it's been that old technology that we've used. And I think only now in the past 7 or 8 years have we come to realize that we really do need to really up our game in being better prepared for flu. And what that editorial was about that I wrote basically said, but we talk a lot about it, but we're not really doing much. We spend $1 billion a year right now or more on HIV vaccine research, and we have for the past 8 years, which I would say is a really very needed investment. This year, the NIH has $30 million to invest in flu vaccines of the future. You know, we can call that a priority, but, you know, just look at where the money goes and you'll realize we still haven't made this a priority. And it's going to take billions of dollars in years to get these new universal flu vaccines, for which we're just not yet committing the resources or the policy importance.
Yeah, and talking about policy, you also write that Congress cutting public health budgets is starting to show.
It is, and you know, there's the old oil fram commercial of years ago, for those old enough on the program listening to remember that, where it says, you can pay me now or you'll pay me later. And I think one of the things that we in public health have tried to do is emphasize the fact that what we're really talking about is something that is going to occur, and it's just a matter of how prepared we'll be at the time when it occurs.
Let me get Anna in here from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
You bet.
My question is this. I work in a small nonprofit. There are 7 of us full-time, and of those 7, one is a pregnant woman who actually just had her baby. Another of us is HIV positive. Another of us is a mother with 2 young kids. And another of us is a full-time caregiver to her elderly mother.
Okay.
How can we encourage or ask our colleagues, our immediate colleagues, to take a flu shot in an ethical, legal manner? Not to mention, being in Boston, we all do take public transportation.
Yeah.
So the likelihood of us bringing something into the office and then taking it home is high.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a cultural question or
got it.
A public health question. How do we do that?
It's a good question, Anna. Thank you. Dr. Schaffner, what would you say?
Well, enthusiasm, education, and availability. If everybody talks about it and educates themselves about the importance of influenza and not transmitting it from one person to another, and then making it available, contract with someone to come in and provide influenza vaccine. That's a small group, but I think it still could be done. And constantly reinforcing the importance of vaccine, as well as the other good things, such as hand hygiene and social distancing when you're sick.
Mm. Michael Osterholm, what would you add to that? What would you tell our caller, Anna?
No, I think that, you know, the flu shot we have today is the best tool we have. And, you know, whether it's 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, it's better than zero. And I think that's an important part of the story. The one thing I would say is that we're learning more and more about influenza. I've been working on influenza for 40 years, and I can tell you I know less about it today than I did many years ago in some ways, because as we've learned more about it, we really realize we don't understand it completely. A good example is we've had recent studies suggesting repeated flu vaccines year after year may lower your protection. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to really work all this information out and give the public this the truth. What do we know? But knowing that the vaccine right now we have is the best tool we have.
Anna, thanks for the call. We're discussing the widespread flu epidemic this hour. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the flu, how bad it's been this year, and projections it will get worse. You can join the conversation. Are we devoting adequate resources to fighting the flu when an epidemic strikes? Should we be working harder to develop a better, more universal vaccine? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking this hour with Dr. William Schaffner from the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine and Michael Osterholm, who leads the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. I wanted to talk for a minute about the economic impact of the flu season. Here's Andy Challenger with the outpatient consultant Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, telling CNBC on Friday he estimates businesses will see billions of dollars in lost productivity during the flu season.
We're predicting about 11 million Americans will fall ill over the flu season, and that's going to cost employers over $9 billion in wages being paid to employees that are staying home sick.
A lot of listeners have input on this. One says, stay at home if you're not feeling well. Impossible. If you need the money and there's no sick leave available, guaranteed paid sick leave 1 to 2 weeks a year is a good start. Another one from Facebook says a big factor in this is employers' policies or lack thereof in terms of ill employees. Too many people go to work sick because their only alternative is lost wages or lost employment, or sending their kids to school sick or to daycare sick for the same reason. Michael Osterholm, speak to that a little bit.
Well, I think, again, this is one of those issues, as we talked about just a few minutes ago. You know, you said you can pay me now or pay me later in terms of dealing with influenza. What we invest in the public health infrastructure, getting good vaccines, being able to deliver them, getting the public to understand that, and then understanding how you keep the virus from spreading. For example, if you are ill coming to work, only puts the rest of your workers at risk of then having them become sick and lose out. And so I think that this is also an effort we have in terms of educating employers about why sick leave is actually not just altruistic, but it's also very strategic in terms of the way you run your business. We haven't always done a good job of that, and we need to help employers understand why that is a very important thing. And they'll say, well, but they may not really be sick. They may just take the time off. Well, I think that, for most people, when they're really sick like that and they have no other choice but to come to work or not get paid, that's a choice we just shouldn't have in the workplace today.
Let's get Elena in here from Portland, Maine. Hi, Elena. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I'm calling to comment on the use of vaccines as prevention and preventative medicine. I think one thing we don't talk enough about our society is the use of food as preventative medicine. One of the doctors earlier quoted an old philosopher, Hippocrates, once said, let medicine be thy food, let food be thy medicine.
Yeah.
And furthermore, I think that within our policy and public health we need to be discussing the foods that our government is subsidizing. There are tons of foods that are just filled with sugar, artificial dyes, that are not contributing to the health of our children, and our children are not going to be able to develop healthy immune systems to fight these diseases if their bodies are being built out of sugar.
I happen to agree with you, Elena. Thank you so much for bringing that up. Dr. William Schaffner, speak about that. Food is preventative medicine, to Elena's point.
Well, obviously, a good diet makes us all healthier, but influenza virus can trump a good diet and a healthy person. As we have already heard on the program, This virus is capable of taking a perfectly healthy child and a perfectly healthy adult and putting them in the emergency room in 24 hours. So we need more than a good diet, good sleep, good hydration, exercise to prevent influenza. Influenza vaccine, as imperfect as it is the best thing we have available at the present time.
Elena, thank you. Here's Regina in Lake Orient, Michigan. Hi, Regina. Welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Go ahead.
I'm a longtime healthcare advocate. Have a health degree and worked in a clinical setting, and then moved my profession to a professional cleaning business. That deals mostly with health. I use non-toxic products. And from going from one profession to another, I see the biggest problem in spreading disease is also the simplest answer, to wash our hands, mm-hmm. to not share what's on our hands, and to get some movement going that in public restrooms, it says everyone wash their hands, not just employees, and to help people understand cross-contamination, possibly if you do have to go to work and you're sick, take a mask.
Yeah, it's a good reminder. That and hand washing is indeed important. Regina, thank you very much. Let's get Richard in here from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Schaffner. A quick question. How effective is Tamiflu, prophylactic use of Tamiflu? If you've been exposed to somebody who has the flu, they prescribe one tablet a day for 10 days. I just want to know if that's effective, or does anybody know how effective it is?
That's good. Thank you, Richard. What do you say, Dr. Schaffner?
So Tamiflu, an antiviral drug, can be used for the treatment of influenza. Again, it's not a miracle drug, but it tends to reduce the duration of the illness a little bit and reduces the likelihood that you'll have a complication. What Richard was talking about is trying to prevent influenza mm-hmm. by using Tamiflu. The places that's been studied best have been in assisted living facilities and nursing homes. If influenza is introduced into that environment, then the use of Tamiflu for everyone in the facility can quickly abort an outbreak of influenza in that facility among those very vulnerable people.
Mm. I have an email question from Allison. She says, my parents, they're over 80 years old, are going on a cruise in February. They've had flu shots. They have filled prescriptions for Tamiflu, but I'm still quite concerned about the flu. I've told them to bring Purell and wash their hands often, but absent of telling them not to go, what else can you suggest? I hear you say, Dr. Schaffner, that Tamiflu might shorten the course of an illness if her parents indeed get that when they're on their cruise, right? I mean, do you recommend that for her?
Well, they're going to take the Tamiflu with them, and if they develop the symptoms of influenza, they should begin the Tamiflu quickly because then it works the best. And they're not going to be at more risk on that cruise ship than they are at home at the present time where we have lots of influenza.
Let's get Jim in here from North Reading, Massachusetts. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on. I had a question about humidity levels in my living environment, having something to do with being healthy, whatnot. I've read that a humidity level of 40% to 50% is healthy for your home or office. In my office, I've measured the humidity level around 22%. I often feel my eyes dry and nose very dry.
Mm. Jim,
so
thank you.
Could the humidity level have anything to do with the factor?
Excellent. Michael Osterholm, speak to that. You're an infectious disease researcher. What do you think?
Well, actually, the humidity issue is one that's a little bit confusing. And I say that because we in the northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere during our winters, obviously we crowd our populations much more inside because it's just cold to be outside. But if you look at the spread of influenza virus in the tropics, where typically the humidity levels are always much higher, we still see sustained transmission during those months of the year, virtually almost all 12 months of the year in those areas. So clearly the health of your mucosal tissue and so forth can be improved by having higher humidity where it doesn't dry out. But the exact relationship between humidity and virus transmission is less clear. This study that was just published this past week looking at the creation of aerosols, these very fine particles, when it was discussed earlier, we think of droplets. These big things that we cough out are like boulders that fall out 3 to 5 feet away, and that's where we have in the past always said a lot of the flu virus was at, but now we have evidence it's in aerosols. Think of that like if you're at the department store and you're four aisles away from the perfume section, but you can still smell it. Mm. That's what an aerosol is like. And so there we know that humidity can play a role in how long aerosols survive, how long they're in the air, and so it's just not really completely clear. So, but it's not a bad thing to have the normal relative humidity in your environment, and whether it really has a lot to do with reducing or increasing flu risk is unclear.
Thank you for that call. Let's get to Anne in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask, the 1918 flu epidemic has already been discussed, but what I was wondering was, is it possible that this year's flu, the virus has mutated like it did in 1918?
Mm-hmm.
Is that too lengthy a process to find out immediately?
Good question, Ann. Michael, what do you say? The flu often beats our best defenses because it is constantly mutating. Isn't that right?
Right. There are actually multiple kinds of mutations that occur in flu viruses. And what we talk about when we talk about a pandemic, we talk about a new strain of virus that basically emerges out of the animal population and not only now can infect humans, but humans can transmit it. So that takes on a whole series of different kinds of mutations. We talk about seasonal flu. These are strains that are already here. And they're changing enough so that they now can infect you potentially, even though you may have had some previous protection, or because, as we've talked about today, the vaccine doesn't match up well and protect you. So we distinguish pandemic strains, those animal-derived ones that suddenly show up and then spread worldwide all of a sudden, versus the seasonal flu strains. And so mutations occur with both, but they're different kinds.
One of our listeners, Kelly, from Twitter asks, does getting a vaccine derived from cells rather than eggs increase the effectiveness of the flu shot? Michael, what do you say?
Yes. One of the things that we're really working on right now is taking the current vaccines and trying to improve them ever so much. They're not going to be what we need for the long term because we still need annual immunizations and we still may have some misses. But we know that if we can, first of all, get the vaccines out of chicken eggs, that some of the potential mutations that actually occur just from growing in the chicken egg, which can impact on how well the vaccine work, goes away. So, yes, it does matter. Cell culture can be a better way to go, and there's even some that are called recombinant vaccines where it's not even the full virus growing. It's parts of the virus that are being expressed in cell cultures through genetic manipulation. Those may even be the best ones. But again, they're not the long-term answer what we need, but they surely can improve on what we experience each year with the seasonal flu vaccine. And that's the vaccines that I have tried to find for myself are the recombinant vaccines in terms of getting better protection.
So we spoke earlier about the universal flu vaccine that's, I guess, in production or at least being experimented with. Your thoughts on this idea, Dr. Schaffner weighed in. What do you say, William Osterholm, about this universal flu vaccine? People like Anthony Fauci at the CDC says it's coming. Yep.
Well, and this is where we have to be very careful. 7 years ago, Francis Collins, the director of the NIH, said we'd have a universal flu vaccine in 5 years. And we're not much closer today than we were then. And again, it's because we haven't made the priority effort. You know, putting a few million dollars here and there into a flu vaccine is not going to get us what we need. It's going to take billions of dollars in extensive collaboration and research to get a vaccine done. And until we actually invest that kind of those resources into this, we're not going to have it. We'll just have these studies that are interesting and surely tantalizing. But to actually get all the way through what we call phase three studies, large clinical trials, where we try to figure out why the vaccine works, how can we measure it, does it work, and how long. And again, I personally don't like the term universal vaccine. There are 18 different kinds of hemagglutinins, the H part of the flu virus, which are very important. And universal implies that we're going to cover all 18. If we cover H1, 2, 3, 5, 7, and 9. That's all we need to cover. We'll cover most of humans. So we call them game-changing flu vaccines. They don't have to cover everything. If they just cover that, that will be a dramatic change moving forward. And then they cover it for multiple years, not just 1 year at a time.
All right. Let's go to Bob in Annapolis, Maryland. Hi, Bob. Not much time left. What's your question? Hello.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I know Dr. Ryder from MIT was working on DRACA, the double-stranded RNA activate caspase oligomerizer.
Okay.
And it was supposed to be cause apoptosis in all viruses, not just influenza, but HIV, et cetera. Is there any more research being done into that field or something ubiquitous for not just influenza, but all viruses in general?
Oh, interesting. Bob, thank you. Michael, what do you say?
Well, there's lots of research going on in vaccines right now that's exciting. But let me just use an example. You know, we, in 2014-15, went through the major tragedy of Ebola in West Africa. And we had a vaccine that we actually were able to show in the field had some protective effect. And we're not really anywhere close yet to finalize licensing that vaccine and then having a manufacturing facility available, which may take years to build and be approved, and then have a market where someone buys it. So just merely having a candidate vaccine in the research setting is a long, long ways from having it be an actually available, highly effective, and usable vaccine in the public. And what we need to do is complete all the dots so that we actually come to that point. And so we're a long ways off yet from that, years. And that's if we today crashed it, meaning made a Manhattan Project-like priority out of it, we'd still be a long ways off.
Bob, thanks for that call. Dr. Schaffner, I'll give you the last word here in our last minute. Your recommendations for people who are sick or not, what do you say?
Well, make a resolution, a somewhat delayed New Year's resolution. Come September and October, let's all get vaccinated, take the whole family, let's do the best we can to do what we can to mitigate the impact of this annual epidemic on our population.
Because when are you most contagious, Dr. Schaffner?
You're most contagious actually the day before you get sick and for the first couple of days after you get sick.
And not everything is the flu, so how do you know if you've really got the flu?
Well, we have diagnostic tests for that, but you're exactly right. Everything that looks like the flu is not. And actually, there are vaccines in research now to prevent some of those other respiratory infections.
Well, a really informative hour at a difficult time for a lot of people. Quite a flu season. Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Great to have you, Michael. Thank you for your information.
Thank you.
And Dr. Bill Schaffner from the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Great to have you, good doctor. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jane, and good to be with you, Mike.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And stay well out there. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.